championship on the line right here. He's going for the corner. He's got it.
Hello and welcome to 4th and 5, your Longhorn Nation podcast. I'm your host, Will Baser, and I'm joined alongside by Joe Cook. You guys are listening to the Horns Cast channel, as what you're listening to right now. Y'all, there's been a lot that has happened since the last time we talked. You know, the biggest one that has to be Texas winning the Sugar Bowl, getting to 10 wins. The first New Year's Six Bowl they've won since 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time they've been there since 2009. It was a huge, huge win for Texas. But not just that. You know, you have also the Under Armour games going on and all the media hype around Texas going into next year. So we're going to go ahead and touch on all of that and then some. Tell y'all what happened to that Sugar Bowl, how it happened, what does it mean, and then talk about the recruits in the Under Armour All-American game and the Adidas All-American game. I don't have to call it now because I just call it All-American. But talk about how they did and all that good stuff. So, Joe, how was your New Year's Eve and New Year's Day and all the holidays?
Oh, it was phenomenal. I think going into New Year's Eve in New Orleans, I was expecting it to be like 6th Street, where everything costs about $50 to $60 and was packed. Very enjoyable. I was in the most popular bar there with elbow room at midnight, and it was perfect. Good old Pat O'Brien's drinking a hurricane. So, surprisingly, would recommend Bourbon Street on New Year's Eve to people. Wow. I was very, very taken aback. But other than that,
that's the hottest take of the day right there.
I know. But other than that, good time seeing family at home. Had a really, you know, enjoyable Christmas. No snow again this year. Maybe next year. But yeah, it's been a good break, and New Year's and Christmas holiday got a lot of downtime, but now it's time to get back from that.
You know, I'm kind of asking this to obviously talk about your holidays, but dude, the first week of the new year for me has been absolutely phenomenal. Like, I went to the New Orleans of the West Coast in Las Vegas, came out there up $1,000. So I don't know how often that happens, but
no, it's a rarity. Dude, at least it is for me.
And the thing is before we were about to leave, we were about to leave, and I had just, on the third day, we had 3 days, lost basically all the winnings I had from the first 2 days. And our plane got delayed, and my friend was like, you know what? Let's go ahead and just go out on a big note. Let's go onto the craps table and just throw around money. And I was like, you know what? Sure, whatever. I have some more winnings. I'll just go ahead. If I leave Vegas even, you know, obviously you never leave Vegas even because of the hotels and food and whatever. But if I leave Vegas even on my gambling money, then I'll be okay. Went onto that table and won $1,000. Just.
Most stories do not end that way.
No.
Just letting you know.
No, the craps dealer was like, you know, there's always time to win back your money, you know, jokingly. And then I did it. And then some. So that on top of the Sugar Bowl, on top of just everything that has happened in this new year has just made it an awesome start. An awesome start. New Year's Day was awesome. New Year's Eve was great, too. It was just a good day. It was a good day. And then, you know, on top of all that, you had the Breckenhager haircutting story with Matthew McConaughey coming out, which, you know, Joe, you have any hot takes on that one?
I think it's pretty funny. It's about time. I'm sure Brecken thinks the same. But nothing was as cool as or as funny to me as walking around kind of on the field pregame, and I'm about to go into the tunnel to get back upstairs, and that's right by Georgia's band. And Georgia's band is a little bit different. Texas band has all those, I don't know if they're cheerleaders or pom squad. I don't know.
The dancer ladies.
Their dance team, something like that. And as I'm walking up the tunnel, ready to go back upstairs, here comes this guy in a leather jacket, and you just see, like, I'm guessing it's about 100 girls. You just see basically 98 of them go, like, is that Matthew McConaughey?
That
and
Matthew
stand
McConaughey?
And start, like, it's something out of a movie. And
that's hilarious. That's awesome.
Luckily, he was kind of past him by the time that could get his attention, and he was with Chris Del Conte, so
of course
he was kind of on a single track mind at that point on the football game. But that was pretty funny to me.
And speaking of everything happening before the game, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Ugga versus Bevo, right?
Yeah.
That was just absolutely insane that happened.
Big dumb cow doing big dumb cow things.
It was
fantastic.
Joe, I do want to ask you, because Chris Bennett on Twitter asked us to go over this. You had quite a beef with a guy who was saying, like, you know, that's a legal issue for Bevo to not be fenced in like that.
I mean, I was, yeah. I mean, he's dumb. It's like he hasn't paid attention to, you know, every Texas home game of the past 90 years. So, whatever. I mean, yeah, there's a possibility that a bull might
do bull things.
You know, be upset, just like there's a possibility that, you know, whatever, man.
A buffalo might run over a guy. He was dumb.
I hope he felt that whatever I said to him wasn't too harsh, but was...
I mean, you made some good points, like, you know, the Sooner Schooner and the Buffalo... What's his name? Ralphie the Buffalo and even the Bear.
Yeah,
I mean,
I don't like
on.
Doing. I'm not
LSU
one for
has a tiger
beefs.
That they prance around campus and stand on top of a cage where there's a live tiger.
Yeah,
like that's not safe. It's just
Well, I mean, it was all in good fun, and I guess as a lawyer, you're used to worse things. So than some random dude telling you about mascots, but Bevo won in more ways than one on the field and outside the field too.
And not only that, it really actually did give the Texas team a jump start into this game. You wouldn't have thought about that, but the team went absolutely crazy in the locker room pregame when they started seeing the videos an hour ahead of the game of Bevo charging at Ugga. And my initial reaction was, oh shit, like, that's not safe, and I'm glad everybody's okay. And then, like, all right, you know, that's pretty cool since nobody got gored. But, I mean, the Texas team, man, they went absolutely ballistic.
Yeah, and I think some reporters asked other players before the game, like, did you see the video? And I think they denied it. But I knew that they had seen it because I have a tweet deck column that has Texas players. And so I grabbed basically every player, put them on a list and put them on a tweet deck column. And I always kind of keep an eye out for it at half times of games just to make sure nothing ever happens again. And so, you know, 55 minutes before the game starts, I see like five or six players start tweeting, and it's only about that. And so in the, you know, minimal amount of time they had in between pregame warm up or a portion of pregame warmups and getting the pep talk and last second stuff from the coaches, they got their phones out and saw Bevo try to go after Ugga. So, I mean, it was inspiring to the fans. I think they saw it. I think everybody who was at home saw it, kind of thought, hopefully the team comes out like that, and they did. And maybe it has to do with them checking their phones a little bit right before the game and seeing it. But, yeah, it was definitely something that kind of, you know, told the tale of what was to come.
Yeah, it was kind of like an omen. I wasn't expecting it to be much of anything other than, hey, you know, it's a funny little footnote on this game. But, boy, did it actually set the tone for the entire team. And you could tell, you know, there's all these national media guys out there right now who are saying, you know, no matter, I'll take a look at Dan Wolkin here. Nope, he's more of a provocateur for sure.
Provocative. That's being real generous.
he definitely, I don't know how much I agree with this, but it's a point. No matter how much you look at this, this was a consolation game for Georgia and the Super Bowl for Texas. You know, that's what the national media is saying here. Now, I don't think there is anyone who can argue that Texas did not want this more than Georgia. And you can see that on the field for sure. Texas wanted this game more than Georgia. And I'm not saying that Georgia did not care about this game at all, because you could definitely tell Georgia did care about this game, and especially going to that fourth quarter, they were freaking out. But the Texas definitely wanted this game more than the opponent. And I think that speaks to where they're coming from and the good job that Tom Herman does in games like this. But it really kind of showed out, especially on that offense. And let's go ahead and get into what happened and how in this game. The Texas offense, you could see it from the get-go. Texas out-physicaled and out-tempoed Georgia, and Georgia did not know what to do with that.
Yeah, I think that's kind of been you know, the Achilles heel is, I mean, we saw, as weird as it sounds, the first year where Johnny Manziel gets into the SEC, they're not used to that type of offense where, you know, a mobile quarterback who's not afraid to go against these, you know, five-star linebackers that they all are proud to have. They weren't, you know, Jake Fromm said it before the game, like, he wouldn't last in our conference. Well, or something along those lines. Well, the thing is, it was just a one game and not a, you know, entire 12-game slate against other teams built to stop things between the tackles. They were not expecting not only a physical game from the offensive line, who played well, a physical game from both running backs, but a physical game from a quarterback, essentially a fullback. That was, you know, plenty of, you know, rotating among three guys. It's what Georgia has done all year to successfully run the football, and Texas kind of did the same thing to them. It really, you know, Trey Watson saved his best game for last. Sam Ehlinger, you know, those three touchdowns, played the way he has all season. It's just, you know, a style of offense that it shares a lot of similarities with maybe what Georgia has seen regularly in their conference, but at the same time, there was a little bit of difference in that it was just coming from multiple different spots. I mean, that extra blocker, there were times, I mean, one of the touchdown runs, it was, you know, this is Georgia stacking the box, getting ready to do what they do best, and that's play between the tackles. Well, when it's 4-on-4, it's going to go to the offense most of the time, and that's what happened. So Texas took the yards there on the ground. Not a lot of opportunities through the air, just as you'll get to, but with limited opportunities in the air, they took advantage of. Little Jordan Humphrey continued to play well, but it was basically the running back duo of Trey Watson and Sam Ehlinger that playing a zone read game that they weren't familiar with and playing it with a physical level that they definitely weren't familiar with.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that Georgia came into this game underestimating Texas. And you could tell that by exactly how they were going about trying to tackle Texas. And what they would do is they would run up, try to deliver a hit, and expect that because they're big and because they're SEC and whatever, that they felt Texas would just fold under these hits. And there was a lot of times where their main tacklers would come blazing into Trey Watson, and Trey Watson would take the hit, bounce off, and go to the outside. You saw that with Sam Ehlinger. You saw that with little Jordan Humphrey at times going down and taking on these linebackers and just bulldozing them, or at least when they get the hit, they didn't go down immediately. I mean, the second play of the game was little Jordan Humphrey getting a ball across the middle, taking a hit, and then Texas just bulldozing him to the 50-yard line. That was kind of what Texas started off with, and you could see it from almost every spot. You talked about the offensive line. We'll get to that in a second, but really, you saw it from the running backs, from the wide receivers, Sam Ehlinger, little Jordan Humphrey. I mean, I saw more pancakes from guys like Trey Watson, Keontae Ingram, and even Daniel Young. And Daniel Young's was huge, pancaking Georgia's, what was it, 6'4", 264, high four-star back in high school linebacker, taking him and pile-driving him in the end zone for Sam Ehlinger to get into the end zone. Like, that is what Texas did to Georgia. And Georgia was not expecting that out of Texas. And it really wasn't that Georgia didn't scout Texas well, because they did. They did on the defensive side. They scouted Texas well. They took away the deep players. They took away little Jordan Humphrey. They took away Colin Johnson, at least limited them in what they could do. I mean, little Jordan Humphrey didn't really have many major breakaways aside from that second play of the game. Colin Johnson had one really big catch where he averages about 5 a game. They bracketed those guys. They tried to stop Texas' run game without loading the box and just said, hey, we're SEC, we're bigger than these guys, and we play this way. And Texas just said, we're going to out-physical you that way. And they did. They weren't expecting it, and Texas did it.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think the fact that little Jordan Humphrey still had a solid game, despite that attention paid to him, kind of says a lot about just how skilled he is. He's that versatile. I mean, there's a reason they call him the Swiss Army knife. Colin Johnson, a little bit more limited, but, you know, once they finally saw that one-on-one matchup, and they saw it twice, they went for him, and they tried to get him the ball, and he made use of it on that big play. So I think you're 100% right, and, you know, we'll get into this a little later, but you contrast that with Texas, who walked down a safety pretty much constantly, you know, on defense. Brandon Jones was always basically either in the box or half-man in the box trying to stop the run. Georgia thought they could do that with their normal guys. And, you know, for a team that, you know, whose coaches and behind the scenes have said all the year, we're good at pass pro, but we're not great at getting a whole lot of push. They got a lot of push, and a lot of it had to do with some formations and schemes that they ran. Changed things up a bit, ran some new wrinkles, but also, you know, doing some stuff that they had picked up on this year. You know, running GT counter continually and doing it effectively because they made an emphasis in that offense. Running power a little bit more effectively because it's an emphasis in the offense. Like, they were doing, they were just executing well against lighter numbers. And once they did, it was time for Trey Watson to take on some safeties.
Yeah, I mean, Texas really killed Georgia with the GT counter and the zone reads. And a lot of this had to do with Georgia really focusing on Sam Ehlinger. With that, Sam Ehlinger would basically take away an entire Georgia defender and then give Trey Watson or Keontae Ingram or whoever it was an ability to get out or at least escape. And as, like I said, Georgia would try to smack them in the mouth with just their body on body, expect Texas to fall over, and then Texas, these guys would just bounce off like it was nothing. And that led to some pretty big runs from Trey Watson. It led to some big runs by Keontae Ingram, led to a big run by Sam Ehlinger. It was just a wonderful job by the running backs there of being able to break the tackle, break down, and then get going. The GT counter especially, I think I saw somewhere that they averaged about 5 yards per carry on the GT counter. And that's fantastic. You're going to win a game that way, especially if that is the run that you're going to over and over and over again. So Texas killed them there. And then on top of that, Georgia was susceptible to that tempo. And that is just something that Bama and Georgia and the defenses that come away from Bama are susceptible to. It's the tempo.
Yeah.
And Texas definitely killed them with more athletic guys, faster paced guys, and guys who are used to playing this way.
Right. And I think you add all that stuff with tempo and take and add into the fact that Kirby Smart was basically the play caller, not Mel Tucker like it had been most of the year on defense. It was a, you know, Georgia's own collaborative effort on defense versus, you know, Texas's collaborative effort on offense, whatever they want to call it. That's a little bit different. That's been different than what Kirby Smart's had to do in his couple years at Georgia. He has a huge hand in the defense, but I'm not sure he was calling plays like he might have been during the bowl game. And adding tempo, adding a bunch of different looks, and adding that all to a situation where Georgia's figuring out, okay, how are we supposed to call defensive plays for this game, just turned into a perfect storm for Texas that they took advantage of.
And you can see that especially up front of the offensive line, where you get into this game and you're saying, all right, Georgia has these big guys. They are fantastic. They've done fantastic against the run. They've done fantastic against the pass for every team they've faced. And Texas's offensive line manhandled Georgia's pass rush. They manhandled it. Now, Georgia did break through a few times, but without DeAndre Walker, Texas's offensive line was able to key on guys, and especially with Georgia helping them out by not bringing very complex blitzes, it helped Texas, which Texas has had trouble with in the past, it helped Texas to really do what they've done all year long, which was do well in the pass rush. And that's what Herb Hand has really helped out Texas. And you looked at Georgia last year and his offensive line last year, and you're like, well, they gave up a lot of sacks, especially to UCF, and that was a huge problem for them. This year hasn't been a huge problem for Texas. And Ehlinger did a fantastic job of when things broke down, he was great at escaping the pocket. And you're looking at me like you're confused about the Auburn thing.
You said Georgia played UCF. So,
Auburn played UCF. My bad. Apologies.
I'm still kind of lost. But yeah, to go on the Ehlinger point, like, that was his probably best game, you know, just being a ball protector and playing as a running back a lot more than he had to play as a quarterback. He only made one kind of off decision, and it kind of ended up being an overturned arm punt that was about the same as the punt that followed it up. But it wasn't, you know, arm punts aren't great, but sometimes they're not the worst decision. That was the only play that looked like freshman Ehlinger, where he was trying to force something. Every other time, he would either deliver the ball on target, take the check down, not try and force anything, or when he saw a lane, he would take it. Or when he had an opportunity, like when I can't believe that Georgia defender missed a blindside sack on him, and Ehlinger was able to duck and run, you know, for about 20-something yards. Like, this was a game where they asked Sam Ehlinger to do a lot more than he had all year. They put the ball in his hands because they knew that the passing game might be limited with the focus. You know, Kirby Smart had talked all week about the receivers, about, you know, about little Jordan Humphrey and Colin Johnson. There was not as much talk about Sam Ehlinger, and as a result, when it came time for, you know, plays to be made, they didn't want Colin Johnson or little Jordan Humphrey to do it. So it went on to Ehlinger, and he was able to, you know, make the right call time after time, took a beating, you know, rushed for, I mean, I think he had 20 rushing attempts or something like that, took a beating, ran the ball four times in on the goal line, almost got there three times and barely got there the fourth. Like, this was a game where he was asked to basically pull the team to victory, and not in like a, well, everybody else is bad, this is all we got way, which he's done in the past. It was basically, you are what they are letting go, so you're going to have to take it.
Yeah, and he did a phenomenal job of doing that. Like you said, escaping the pocket in more ways than one, where you're like, how did he do that? There was that one that you talked about where he ducked a blindside hit, which is just, it's, you don't see that very often, and for good reason, right? And then there's the other one where he had basically four guys collapse on him, and if you were to look at that play and you would pause it and you were to say, all right, what happens here? And if you were to say, oh, it's a touchdown, you'd be almost crazy. But it happened. He escaped the pocket, scored a 9-yard touchdown. He did that so many different times in so many different ways that Georgia just had no answer for him with their linebackers or with their defensive line. And it ultimately led Texas to winning because he had those three touchdowns.
Yeah, it was just, you know, making something out of nothing in the past game when it was, when there was not a lot there, and then whenever he needed to make the play, he did. Like that like the scramble you just mentioned. Like, I know Todd Blackledge said it looked like a draw, but that looked like, you know, they were setting up little Jordan Humphrey for a corner route. All the other receivers were running routes. It looked like a pass play that went awry really quickly and almost did, and he somehow sneaked his way between, you know, a couple tacklers and made his way into the end zone almost unscathed.
Right, and what that did was allowed for a guy like Trey Watson, as we talked about, to have a game where he rushed 18 times for 94 yards, netted 31 yards because of a 3-yard loss on a kind of a BS at the very end of the first half run, but averaging 5.1 yards per run. He had a phenomenal game because UGA was so focused on Sam Ehlinger and his ability with his feet. And kind of leading into the defense was, aside from the end of the game, Texas had three penalties for 15 yards, and one of them was intentional. Texas played...
not the targeting, the delay of game.
Not the targeting. Right. I'm saying besides the end of the game, yeah. Right? Texas had three penalties, and one of them was intentional. That was something you haven't really seen from Texas, or at least at times you saw from Texas, and that's when you saw the winning efforts. Texas played mistake-free ball against this Georgia defense, and that was a really, really huge factor for beating Georgia, both on the offensive side and the defensive side. I was watching with my brother, and every time Texas would do something, every time there was a tackle or something, you almost saw the difference between the Big 12 squad and any other squad. But there were a lot of calls that if there was in the Big 12, they probably wouldn't have been flags. But here, they let them play, and it was really huge for Texas in making sure that they didn't give Georgia any first downs, free first downs, any free plays, any drive-killing penalties. Huge.
Yeah, I mean, the only penalties I can think of on offense were a couple Andrew Beck false starts and then the holding on the arm punt. And that's how you win. I mean, for all the talk about, you know, possibly playing against the best defensive front that you're going to face, there were no holding penalties called on any run plays, I believe, that Texas had in this game. And that's against this lauded defensive front that Georgia has. Georgia did not have much of a pass rush, and especially missing their best pass rusher. He was basically it as far as that goes, and Texas made sure that they stopped at what was an average pass rush unit with their offensive line this play. So kept everything clean, no interference penalties, nothing like that, just those targetings, which will cost Texas Anthony Cook for a half against Louisiana Tech next year. But other than that, like you mentioned, just a really clean game.
Yeah, and there's one more thing I forgot to talk about before we get into the defense, and it's me wanting to put Ehlinger's record-breaking season in perspective. He had 16 rushing touchdowns on the year, which broke, I believe, right? That broke Vince Young's rushing touchdowns in a single season. Now, when you're looking at that, you have to also look at the different eras. This era is a lot different than what Texas was back in 2005. Vince Young was I don't have to say this. Vince Young was a different runner than Sam Ehlinger. Sam Ehlinger, all 16 of his touchdowns were inside of 16 yards. His 16-yard touchdown run was the biggest one of the year. And I believe that was against Oklahoma. Compared to where Vince Young was, where there were a lot more runs with his quarterback, there was a lot more conventional offense. It was the beginning of really the zone read, which is what Texas wrote on the back to the national championship. You're looking at these and you're saying, all right, how much is this actually the offense is changing and really Sam Ehlinger doing well? Looking at this offensive-wise, I'm saying Sam Ehlinger was special in this case. Not because of his flashy runs, but because of the offense he was in, which, again, this year was more of a passing offense. That's where you got your yards. His ability to get 16 touchdowns was really something that's special. You haven't seen that from a lot of Tom Herman's offenses in the past, and not even, you had to go back to, as the announcers said, Tim Tebow for Urban Meyer to see something like that. So Sam Ehlinger's ability to get run, be a more of a running back, bulldoze over guys at the quarterback, is special. And his ability to get the 16 touchdowns this year, and I believe 44 counted touchdowns, is special.
Yeah, I think a big reason behind Sam Ehlinger breaking that record is back when Vince Young was playing, and I may be getting the years wrong a little bit, they had rushing options like Cedric Benson, Jamal Charles, Cody Johnson,
Henry Melton,
Ramont Taylor might have had Henry Melton for a year. I know Cody Johnson's way too young to be on those teams. Maybe Vondrell McGee. I don't know. They had a lot
That's
more.
A name I haven't heard in quite a while.
Yeah, they had a lot of offensive weapons, especially in the backfield during Young's time, and even at tight end. Just thinking Lima Swede, other guys to where that offense was able to spread the ball around a little bit more, specifically maybe in the goal line situations or in scoring. Vince still racked up 14 touchdowns, whereas I was looking at the stats today, I think the Texas running backs had about either 5 or 6 combined rushing touchdowns. That kind of tells the story a little bit too, whereas for Ehlinger, if it was short yardage, he was getting the ball. And there was a lot of short yardage goal line situations because this team didn't have a lot of explosive plays that put Texas inside the 5 a lot. And it's like, well, let's just go with Ehlinger and what works. So a little bit of an explanation as to why he got those numbers compared to maybe how Vince got those numbers. But still, the fact that you can rely on your quarterback to do that with that much efficiency to break a record at Texas, basically relying on that one play, on that one facet, still very impressive.
Yeah, exactly. As you point out, there's two ways to look at this. There's, hey, Sam Ehlinger is the offense and that's what makes him special. And hey, Vince Young was able to do this with all those weapons and that's what makes him special. So there's two ways to look at this. Both of them, you have very special quarterbacks. And that's something we'll get back into is, hey, Texas finally has a quarterback. But let's go ahead and talk about that after this defense, because this defense played absolutely phenomenal. And this is really a big point and reason why Texas won this game, was the UGA offense basically was a walk in the park compared to all the Big 12 offenses they faced this year. After facing dynamic offenses in the Big 12 that attack every issue, every schematic flaw you have, every personnel flaw you have, going up against this very vanilla UGA offense must have been a breath of fresh air for this Texas team. They played directly into Todd Orlando's hands, because what he does is he kills conventional offenses. USC has seen this. You've seen it against Missouri last year. When you have a drop back, pocket passing, try to run it down your throat without any gimmicks offense, Todd Orlando is able to scheme around that and really make you pay for it.
Yeah, I think he did a great job in that game. He also had a you know, performances by his whole linebacking core that might have been the best of the season for that group. Jeffrey McCulloch did well, but Joseph Osai and Gary Johnson both had really fantastic games. Gary Johnson made a lot of noise in the pass rush. My big concern going into this game was, you know, Georgia's big offensive line going up against a guy who's probably 220 pounds as a linebacker. That was, you know, he had his troubles in run stopping, but his play as far as a blitzer was really, really fantastic. He was responsible for a sack. All the linebackers, you know, had a hand in that interception. Anthony Wheeler got pressure on Fromm. And so all those linebackers really had a great game as far as blitzing and in run stopping. I mean, you know, the commentators talked over and over again about how this rush offense was being stopped by the Texas front. It was a great effort from everybody on defense, but I think maybe you and I can agree or disagree on this. The two best games were by Charles Menehu and PJ Foster.
Oh, you know, maybe we could get into that. I would say, you know, Menehu had a fantastic game. So did Joseph Osai. I mean, here's the thing: is the way Georgia played really played into the hands and really put guys like Chris Nelson, BJ Foster, PJ Locke, Anthony Wheeler, Gary Johnson in their natural element, where they are helped out by a run-heavy team, which is what they're good at. BJ Foster, PJ Locke especially. Chris Nelson is, you know, he has trouble with the pass rushing, but when it comes to filling up run gaps, that's where he does well. Anthony Wheeler and Gary Johnson, there's not much gimmicks in that offense, so there's no misdirection, there's no trickery from UGA, and that helps him out mentally, because that's where Anthony Wheeler had trouble, was mentally kind of figuring out where to go, and then Gary Johnson would have to pick up where Anthony Wheeler was having trouble. So those guys had a phenomenal game. I guess you're right, it allowed a guy like Omenihu to finally break out and go up against these crazy Georgia offensive line who has been killing it all year long except for against LSU, and really play. He just bounced off guys. How many tackles did he have? Two solo tackles, and both of them were sacks for 6 yards. He was a monster, a disruptive force in that backfield because of his ability to finally get some breathing room and his ability and allow his natural ability to flourish because of what Texas was doing. And there was no trickery, so there was nothing that he really had to hold back and be like, oh, well, maybe the quarterback's going to run here. No, I mean, he did, but he's not fast enough to beat out a guy like Gary Johnson, right?
Right. And a play in the game very much illustrated that. Like, Gary Johnson bounced off a tackle, left tackle, and then Fromm was going upfield, and then he was able to catch up to him going upfield. So just everybody was able to play a game where they didn't have to do a lot of thinking. That's always good on defense. You just had a very basic assignment. I think one thing that we didn't really touch on was that Brandon Jones was brought down a lot, or we did touch on Brandon Jones was brought down a lot to be an extra run defender. And Georgia was stubborn about it. They still said, okay, we're going to try it anyway. And it didn't work. You know, they have a bubble game. They have a tight end passing game that they didn't utilize. They thought that they could run over this Big 12 defense. And it didn't work because it not only did those Texas players play with toughness and effort, but there are also just more of them than what an offensive line can typically block in the box.
Right, and you saw this in multiple spots where, especially on that big sack to end the second half, or the first half, to stop Georgia from kicking a field goal, Texas brought six, and Georgia had six offensive linemen, but they brought it in such a way that it confused that offensive line and caused a protection breakdown. But you're right, Texas dared Georgia to pass the ball. They did what Oklahoma did to Texas, where Oklahoma was like, we're going to basically make it so that you have to pass the ball with us, and then we'll see who wins in this shootout. Texas did that to Georgia. They brought 6-8 in the box, like you said, often bringing a quarterback in there, especially Boyd off the boundary side, with a zone over top or a safety coming down like BJ Foster or Brandon Jones, basically lining up next to the linebackers with man over top. And this led to two fumbles. One of them was caused by Taquan Graham, but the other one was obviously caused by BJ Foster. Should have been Texas's ball if Gary Johnson doesn't try to scoop and score. But Texas made sure that they had more guys in the box than Georgia, said, all right, you're not beating us in this run. We know you have two, three really, really good running backs. And they were good. I mean, you saw Elijah Holyfield and Herrion and maybe not DeAndre Swift this game, but definitely those two guys run over Texas players. Like, they gave him the business at times. But Texas had more guys, even if they missed tackles, had more guys in the box so that they could swarm the ball. And that is what, and with Todd Orlando not having to worry about misdirections and all this other stuff, they were able to completely focus on that one particular part of the game. And Georgia did not adjust to this until the fourth quarter when they were like, oh God, we have to do something. So you're right. Texas put those six guys in the box and just said, come at us. And Texas out-physical Georgia in that regard. And you're right. B.J. Foster had a phenomenal game in this regard because he's one of those rangy defensive backs that the NFL is looking for more and more these days. And they're probably going to come to Texas more. You have Overshown, a guy like Overshown, a guy like B.J. Foster, a guy like Caden Stearns. Very rangy defensive backs. Don't really have a position. Maybe Caden Stearns has more of a one, but you can put him anywhere. And that is more of what the NFL teams are looking for. And you saw that in B.J. Foster. I mean, man, where do you put that guy on this team? Do you put a linebacker? I mean, he can play B linebacker for all that it's worth. And be an incredibly good B linebacker in coverage. Or you could put him all the way back in safety where, you know, he had a mental breakdown, which almost led to a Georgia touchdown if Fron doesn't overthrow the guy.
Mm-hmm.
But you can still do that. And he's just such raw instinct. He has such explosive play that you don't know where you can put him. You can put anywhere on the field, and that's what an offense has to plan for. And it's hard to do that.
He might be going into next year the best football player on the defense just because of his versatility. I know there's a lot to be said about a guy like DeMarvian Overshown, who we didn't see much of this year, and Caden Stearns, who we saw a lot of this year. They both probably have good arguments for that. But as far as, you know, versatility and being a good football player, pretty much no matter where he lines up, I don't think anybody can touch B.J. Foster on that defense.
Yeah, and not only that, going into next year, talking about that, the defensive line played phenomenal, and not just the guys like Omenihu and Nelson, and even Hager had a good game, not a fantastic game, but he had a good game. He should never play at 4i in the next level ever again, or, you know, just in football in general. But guys like Ojemo and Roach and Coburn and Taquan Graham and Wilbon had just phenomenal games. I mean, Wilbon really played well. He was all over the field. He's like, all right, next year, nose tackle is mine. Taquan Graham, he was the guy who forced that first fumble. It wasn't given to him, but he's the guy who did it. And he was all over that line. He's a guy who is a natural replacement for Omenihu. And he's actually more of a natural 4i than Omenihu is because of just his ability to have more weight on him than Omenihu. Then you also have Coburn and Ojemo out there. You know, obviously, I guess I overstated Ojemo's injury. I'll eat that one for sure. But he had a phenomenal, I mean, I saw him break through a few double teams in the pass rush. That is phenomenal for a freshman against this type of offensive line. That is phenomenal. And then you have Roach, Coburn. It's just like this Georgia offense, this offensive line, especially these offensive tackles, had trouble with these more speedy and athletic defensive lines. And even when Texas brought the size, they had more athleticism than Georgia did.
Yeah, I think in Coburn's case, he's a guy that really caught my eye. I know a lot of people were concerned about his weight coming into college, you know, where he would whether he'd get above or below the Coburn level. He is what he is. He's a large nose tackle meant to be a nose tackle and a force in the middle. He's still young. He didn't burn his red shirt this year. Only played, I think, in four, maybe three games. But you can just tell out there that he has a lot of fun playing the game. He plays with a lot of effort. He had a really nice tackle, his only tackle of the game. And, you know, he provided a lot of rotational snaps so that the starting defensive line later in the game as the game went on would be a little bit fresher. I think the play that does it for me is you see him, I think he made a tackle or he was involved in a tackle, his helmet bounces off, and he picks up his helmet and just runs right back towards the sideline because he wants to get over there and get back in for the next play. I think for a guy that a lot of people may have been worn a bit thin from during his recruiting process as one of the handful of guys that didn't sign early, I think any fears you had about that can be dispelled. Like he's a guy that gives full effort. We'll see where his game goes, but you talked a lot about Ojemo and how, yeah, he looked impressive too, especially at that end spot, but I think Coburn looked pretty darn good as well during his limited snaps.
Yeah, and also,
then Osai, who's just...
Yeah, I was about to say.
Who was working everybody out there as a starter. That guy just does some things on the football field. It's sometimes not the plays he makes, like, you know, ripping around a left tackle or, you know, putting a good bull rush together. But it's sometimes the stuff that he does that allows other to make plays, like being, you know, off the edge and just scraping down the line of scrimmage to where it messes up with a guard so the defensive tackle can make the play. Like, he does a lot of stuff that... I mean, I can't even think of a word to describe it. Just natural talent.
It's a wonderful pickup by Texas last year, stealing him away from A&M. I mean, you're right. He did a fantastic job scraping off the back of that offensive line and then picking up that running back against Georgia. He did that multiple times and did a phenomenal job of really stuffing a lot of these Georgia runs that could have gone places if he had not been there. But the defensive backs played well as well. You know, we've been ragging on Chris Boyd this entire year. Mm-hmm. Especially me. Mm-hmm. I've been ragging on him all year long because, you know, he's susceptible to a lot of different things. He played a phenomenal game here. He really shut down the guys he was on. He played great up top. He was able to stuff the run. They used him a lot in the run coverage, making sure that side was contained. But again, Todd Orlando thrives against these conventional offenses because of his ability to throw these crazy mixed and disguised coverages where you probably couldn't do that against a team like Oklahoma, that could make you pay if you mess up somewhere. Against Georgia, there's nothing flashy there, so he was able to do that, and it caused a guy like Jake Fromm to have a very off game. I mean, one of the best passers in the game, at least one of the most efficient passers in the game, was just off target and off tempo. He was not on the same page with his wide receivers. His wide receiver said that after the game. The guy he likes to throw to, number 9. I don't remember his name
either
off the top of my head.
Cole Hardeman or Riley Ridley.
Yeah, one of those guys basically said, "We couldn't get anything on the same page because Texas kept on throwing all of these different coverages at us, and it made it so that we couldn't get on the same page as Jake Fromm." Jake Fromm said as much there, saying we couldn't make any adjustments. He said that they were showing off looks, constantly mixing things up, and it caused him to have one big play to P.J. Locke where he thought he had time, but all of a sudden there's Anthony Wheeler in his face. Then he doesn't have enough time to throw it, underthrows it, and P.J. Locke is right there. Something that he could have had in most games, but he didn't have here because Texas was just throwing so much at him that he could not process. And on top of that, Texas's defensive backs did a phenomenal job of limiting the damage from Georgia. Now, Georgia, towards the end of the game, had a few breakout throws. I mean, you saw some from 24, 22 yards, 31 yard to Holloman. But you saw most of the time where they took Georgia's high percentage throws and let these short passes from UGA, they made sure that they didn't break out. They sniffed them out. And aside from one where Ridley stayed on his feet miraculously, they really were able to limit those types of passes that Georgia has used to be explosive. That is another reason Texas won this game. But one of the biggest reasons Texas did win the game was special teams. And that's the third part of the game everybody always forgets. But that's where Texas won, and they won big. They won big there because Texas was able to get the field position battles because of Georgia's blunders on special teams that were silently killing Georgia. Maybe not silently, because that first punt was huge, and it kept in that punter's mind. The first punt was a 66-yard swing, which took Texas from inside their 5 to on UGA's 27. And then the second punt was a shank that went to the Texas's 50, or went to the 50-yard line. Like, that's a huge, huge swing.
Yeah, and that's in contrast to Ryan Puchevsky, who like, once again, he's not his cousin, but he's still pretty good as a freshman punter. Tried to look up the stats today, and he doesn't have great statistics, but at the same time, his net is very, very close to his gross. I think, you know, he was averaging 40 yards or so a punt, and average, net would be about 36. You want better than that, but for somebody this year who's kind of just now getting his feet wet in college football, getting his feet wet in American football, not bad. There were really no, I can't really think of any times other than a few shanks where, you know, something bad happened. I mean, am I missing a, you know, a blocked punt maybe or a fumble? I can't really think of anything. You know, he punted like a freshman punter. So, you know, and like you mentioned, he did not make mistakes, whereas the opposing punter did.
Yeah, he had four punts out of five punts, four punts inside the 20. And the one punt that wasn't inside the 20 was the punt that bounced to end the first half. It bounced from the 50 to the 25-yard line and ran out the time in the first half, making sure that Georgia did not have that last chance heave to give them some sort of a hope. He snuffed out hope, basically, yeah, is what he did.
Exactly.
And then Cameron Dicker going 2 for 3. I mean, he just had a phenomenal year in general, but Cameron Dicker going 2 for 3. He whiffed on that 45-yarder, but beside that, he had a great game here. Two screw-ups, but Texas is special teams. And you look at a guy like Rodrigo Blankenship, Georgia on the paper has the advantage, but Texas came out and just whipped them up and down the field. Every single phase of the game, Texas beat Georgia. And that is how and why Texas beat Georgia. And it's phenomenal. But you have to talk about what does it mean. And because a lot of the national media is taking a look at this and saying, as we talked about at the beginning of the show, you know, Georgia didn't want it, Texas did, and that's why Texas won. And it kind of makes sense. It, honestly, if you take a look, take a step back, you say, yeah, Texas wanted this game more. And we talked about that. But what does it actually mean for Texas? How much can you take away from this game? And what does it mean going forward for Texas? And you have to say, it's just a huge momentum swing for Texas, right?
Yeah, I wrote before this game happened that said this a win in one of the last two games is what separates this from, you know, being a good or a great season. I said that if Texas either won the Big 12 title, which they didn't, or if they, you know, win this Sugar Bowl against Georgia, I wrote that after the Big 12 title game, that, you know, 10 wins, beating one of those two teams, that turns this into a great season. I honestly think that this 10-4 year, second year of Tom Herman, was a great Texas football season. But it's also what a lot of people expect to kind of be happening on a year-in, year-out basis. Competition and winning the conference title, winning or competing against bowl opponents like Georgia in this stature of bowl. It hadn't happened in a while, which is, I think, why this was a great season. And I think, you know, everybody's going to talk about momentum over and over again until they're blue in the face, but this does give momentum. I mean, it's a lot better to go into the offseason with a win and a loss. It dispels a lot of other negative recruiting pitches that Texas could have come across, and gives them, you know, just creates that good feeling that it had last year about, hey, we won, things are looking okay. So I think this kind of puts a cap on a great season, 10-4. You know, in most other worlds, it's kind of like 10-3, that, you know, getting an extra game in because of the, well, I take that back. It's 10-4, but there was an extra game on the schedule because of how Texas played and got into contention for the Big 12 championship.
Yeah. And like you said, it should help Texas in building the program. This win is a program building win. You take this and you take this to recruits' living rooms and you talk to them and you say, all right, hey, we faced the SEC 2 times in a row and we are 2-0. These are the games we've done it in. This is the fashion we have done it in. It's been dominant and we will do it over and over and over again. You pitch that. It's a great pitch. It is a phenomenal pitch. You can even go and say, hey, we beat Oklahoma. We beat Oklahoma the first time. And it's hard to beat a team that's quality twice in a row. You see that in the NFL. We talked about that before the show, before the game. But we have to also look at, you know, what it means in the national media. And everybody is asking the question, is Texas back? That is the question. And Sam Ellinger had his own answer for it. And that was honestly hilarious that he did it. I mean, it's a callback to Vince Young, but it was just, I was like, I can't believe he did that.
Yeah, and I think,
not so much Ellinger's comments, but Omenihu's comments after the game. He said, somebody asked him about it. What do you think about him saying that? And Omenihu said, I think the perfect thing. He's like, I want my quarterback to be saying that. I want him to be confident in saying that. Like, I want him to continue to say that. So that way you have a bunch of people trying to play to continue to keep Texas up to that standard. That's what Omenihu's sentiment was after the game. And I think that kind of stands a little bit more important to me than what Ellinger said, because somebody was going to make the joke at some point. And it's nice that, right, that it was Sam Ellinger accepting the MVP trophy that when that happened. But I think the fact that, you know, the players seem to believe that, like, yeah, we're back and we got to work hard to stay back. And I think the whole, if it wasn't for Joe Tessitore screaming at the end of a double overtime game, nobody would really care how back Texas was. But I think this has definitely put Texas as its in its spot as a top 10 program in the country that can compete for those results year in and year out.
Yeah, I guess you're right. But I think when you're looking at this game and you have to say, okay, how much does this victory mean? Does it mean more for where Texas is or more for where Georgia is? You know, was it a fluke? It's going to be a question. And that's the thing that is the big question for Texas. And it's a big question for Tom Herman in his tenure as a head coach in general. Texas wins the big games. They do, or at least they show up for them. More times than not, Texas will win against a spread when they are the underdog. Tom Herman, that's just his MO. And I think the question being, is Texas back? You can answer that after a big game. You can answer that now against Georgia. It's the games that are in between that lead up to Georgia, that lead up to Oklahoma, that lead up to Louisiana State, LSU, that lead up to whoever your big opponent is, that determine if Texas is back or not. Because I think when there is consistency across their schedule, when they can go in to Oklahoma State and not give up 28 points in the first quarter, when they can go to Maryland and not give up 24 points in the first half, when they can go up against Baylor and Kansas and Tulsa and not have to worry about, okay, is this going to be a game? That is when you know Texas is back, is when they play their best ball against mediocre teams or bad teams as well as the good teams. Because I still think Georgia is a top four team in the nation, at least top 10. Texas, when they have all cylinders go, they can play with any team in the nation, maybe aside from Bama. But again, it is those teams in between, the Oklahoma States of the world, the Kansases, the Kansas States, that once you start beating those teams, then you can proclaim, yeah, Texas is back. Until then, you're going to take a team that could have been 12-2 and turn them into a 10-14. And at some point, Texas fans are going to get annoyed by that. And, you know, while I'm saying this, you know, I know I have a reputation for being a Debbie Downer here, but I hope you're not coming into these shows expecting me to fanboy out and spout Kool-Aid. I'm going to come to these shows and try to be as realistic as possible. I'm not trying to blow smoke up your ass here. Like, that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to make sure that, hey, you understand that, yeah, this game is great. It's a momentum builder. It is a program-building game. It is a wonderful game, and you should celebrate the hell out of it. But it does not mean that your team is back quite yet. There are a few more steps that have to happen before you can say, yes, we can actually compete for a playoff spot and for a national championship. Until then, the highest you can go is an N6 bowl. And hey, that's not a bad thing, but Texas fans, you want more than that.
Yeah, 100%.
So let's go ahead and talk about, you know, the momentum building. And you start off with this class, this next class coming in, this 2019 class. You have quite a few really great players coming in. And you saw some of these players in over the past week in All-American games. And we'll start off with the Under Armour game. I was there for that. Oh, no. You were the one watching.
Right.
I'm getting these two confused. There's the Adidas one and the Under Armour game. Blech. But you saw the Under Armour game. I was in Vegas. I was not in a mental state to
you were in,
watch that
you
game.
You were in Vegas.
I was in Vegas. So we had Rashawn Johnson, Marcus Washington, and Braden Leibrock in that game. Oh, and also David Gabenda, or Benda. So talk to me about these players. Who was the most impressive? I would imagine it'd be Marcus Washington.
Marcus Washington, definitely, because he won the MVP award for his team, which I believe was Team Ballaholics. He had, I think, 2 touchdown catches, looked good during out the day, and you know, just he apparently had a pretty good week there too. Was not able to catch as many updates on Under Armour because of the Sugar Bowl and travel, but I mean, you don't get the MVP award and get on to sit on some silly touchdown throne that Under Armour put together twice if you don't have a good game. Rashawn Johnson was a starting quarterback for his team. Looked all right. I mean, he was given the opportunity to run a little bit more than I thought he would in a All-America game. Had a few nice passes up undone by some solid defensive plays that bordered on penalty. But nothing really that, you know, there was no performance this year from a Texas commit like one of B.J. Foster last year really blowing people up, or like Keontae Ingram, where a lot of people were like, oh, I don't know if he's that good. He's not really showing burst, even after he had just won a state title for, you know, however many years in a row it was. Braden Leibrock didn't really look like they got him involved in the game too much. He was basically the tight end for Team Flash, the white team, but it didn't really look like they did much to get him involved. And then on Team Ballaholics, you had Benda was on Flash as well, and he started off the game with a pretty good tackle, had another one later on, did not look out of place there. And then on Team Ballaholics, like with the aforementioned Washington and Kenyatta Watson, who was never really tested, didn't seem like it. One play, he didn't look great, but that was basically the only play that ever came to his side. So overall, I mean, nothing good or bad to really be gleaned like from these games, but you know, at the same time, all these guys kind of looked like they belonged in a high school all-star game.
Yeah, and what I really enjoyed watching from Marcus Washington is seeing what was on his tape brought into an All-American game. What you saw on his tape is his ability to find space and create space with his body. He's a very technically smart guy, and you saw that in this game. Both of his touchdowns were prime examples of those two concepts. The first one was his ability to find the soft spot in a zone, especially when a play was breaking down, and it gave his quarterback a spot to throw it, and ends up in a touchdown. The second one is him creating space with his body. He was able to box out a guy like basketball and catch the ball in the end zone because of his awareness, his understanding of the game, and his abilities. That is what I've really enjoyed watching about Marcus Washington. That's what I'm expecting to see out of Marcus Washington coming to Texas. You put some weight on him, you put some size on him, give him some more speed, and he is a threat. Rashawn Johnson, again, you said, hey, you know, it's with a lot of times in these games, the offensive lines, you need time to gel, and you didn't see that a lot, especially for the teams that Texas was on. For Rashawn Johnson, that offensive line didn't gel very well. A lot of pass protection blow-ups, and Rashawn Johnson did well with what he had to do. Gabenda, like you said, I mean, that guy, Texas, at least we know that Texas will have guys who fly to the ball from the linebacker position, and that's where I'm going to bring it into the Adidas game, that All-American game, with Floyd. Floyd had an incredible week all week long. He was blowing up plays in practice. He was finding ways through the gaps. He was basically shuffling through the garbage to get to the running backs. He did a phenomenal job of that, again, in live reps in this game. He played phenomenal, and he's a guy who is he's coming in as an early enrollee. We'll see how well he picks up this defense, but boy, oh boy, did he look exciting in what he has been billed to be. And not just that, you didn't really see him too much in protection, pass protection, pass defense. And that's one thing I really am excited to see from Floyd, because he played safety in high school. He's a guy who played safety and linebacker. You can throw him anywhere all across the field, and that's what I like about him. He's very versatile, but he knows how to find the ball. He just has a nose for it, and he showed that during that game. You watch that. What do you think, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, I was there, and I think you and I may have saw the quote that Mike Roach got from one of the coaches there, who was an offensive coach, but said that they had to very much adjust the defensive, the offensive practices for the West squad because of how disruptive DeGabriel Floyd was. So that's a real exciting prospect. Probably a guy who's ready to play physically day one, but has got to pick up on the mental stuff of the game and maybe, you know, adjusting to the speed of the college game. But he's about as good as a middle linebacker prospect you could ask for in any class.
And then you have Tyler Owens, who looks like a linebacker, man. When I saw him, he was bigger than I was expecting. He's 6'2", 220 is what he told me. And he doesn't run like it. He runs like he is 5'8", 150, has light as a feather, but he hits like he's 300 pounds, 6'5". So that's what you get out of Tyler Owens. But he did have a few plays. I mean, you saw that. He had a few plays where, man, he laid the hit. But there was other plays where, even on his pass breakup, that's probably a pass interference in the next level. He didn't turn his head around. He was all over the player. Yeah, it looked great, but on review, probably needs to work on and build that up and be taught the technical side. He also had some runs where, hey, you know, if you make a better angle to the quarterback there, you're not diving at his feet and missing. But you saw what he can be and what he is right now. So obviously you're going to get him a red shirt, but he has the ability to be like B.J. Foster, another rangy defensive back who is very versatile. You can throw him anywhere because of his athleticism.
Yeah, and then I guess the last but not least would be Jordan Whittington.
Yeah, and you know, you didn't really see too much because, my lord, the east side just destroyed the west side, especially on offense. I mean, the offensive line for Oklahoma, those two commits, they've had better days. They definitely had. I mean, you know, you saw him being used as a running back at times, and that was probably what you're going to see at Texas. Jake Smith and Jordan Whittington have a lot of very similar skill sets. So that means that you're going to have to figure out a way how to get them on the same field together. Now, the obvious way you do that is by putting them in the backfield, putting one out wide, putting one in the backfield. And you saw it with Jordan Whittington getting handed the ball off sometimes. He probably would have had a touchdown if the ball wasn't snapped 15 yards over his head. So, you know, I'm excited about Jordan Whittington, what he has been shown, what the coaches thought about him and his abilities. Coming from these games, you saw, all right, here's some limitations from these players, but also there is a lot to be excited about for this 2019 class. And there's more to come with National Signing Day 2 coming up. But we'll go ahead and talk about that next week on the show, along with just a overview of the season, 2018 season. We'll just wrap that all up in a nice little gift basket, bow, and everything. But this has been 4th and 5, your Longhorn Nation podcast. I've been your host, Will Baizer. You guys can find me on Twitter at WILLBAIZER. And my man, Joe Cook. Where can we find you, bud? You
can find all my stuff at InsideTexas.com. You can find me on Twitter at JosephCook89. And it's time for more sports. Football's done. Now it's time for basketball and baseball.
Basketball. Oh, yeah.
Really get the full swing.
And hockey. And hockey. Although my Blues suck ass.
So do the Kings. They got fire coach midseason bad, and the 70s
Same
line
here.
Is now
Same
all
here.
30-something, so...
Woo! Hooray. But you guys are listening to the Horsecast Channel. It's the Horsecast Channel right here. We have another great podcast that you guys can find on Spotify, Podbean, Twitter, iTunes, Google Play. Anywhere you guys can find a podcast, you will find the Horsecast. And on that note, thank y'all for listening, and we will see y'all next week. Hook 'em.